I wonder if we could start with a bit of a googly, unadvertised topic. The brouhaha around the Garrick Club, it strikes me that you're the sort of gentleman who might take an interest in many of the denizens of this place and to break bread with them. Suddenly, there is a bit of a hornet's nest emanating from the feminist community saying that it's a male-only club and should be effectively blackballed by many people who've valued it hitherto. Should they have a change of heart? Does it need a new groom?
Yes, I think it's well. There's things they've got away with for years, but it's kind of inevitable, I think, don't you?
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel sexist about saying that there's sometimes a place for people to get away from their complementary gender. On the
Yes.
same principle that if you go shopping, there are what's called men's creches, aren't there, where you can just be provided with some light alcohol and sporting entertainment or whatever it is, while the essentials are done that would otherwise drive you barmy.
Yeah, I think there is. It's like playing football. I mean, you have men's and women's football teams, so yeah, they could say, well, you have to have a mixed team, you want equality. But no, I think it's I don't think it should be made illegal, but they obviously have to declare their policy if they want to be an all male club. I think they let women in on special status, don't they?
I would not be at all surprised. I mean, it used to be called officers' wives, didn't it? Things like that in the military. It seems terribly dated in those terms. But I wonder if its antiquity is a re it should be a reason for its demise. Mal, hello, how are you?
Hello. Hi.
Great. I hope you're feeling better. Thank you very much for persevering with the confidant. We're starting with a topic I didn't advertise: the situation at the Garrick Club, and whether there should be. I suppose single-sex bastions, where possibly sort of soft core conversations about matters of national import can be had, words to the wise and so forth. Are they good things, or should we be tearing them all down?
I don't know. I mean, it seems to me if we defend women's spaces, and that's become a very major issue with
As we were
the
saying
issue
last
around
time.
trans rights and that very sort of thorny way of getting that balance right. But it seems to me rather strange that we should have women-only spaces but not men-only spaces as a general principle. That being said, I think some of the it does depend the I guess to an extent the nature and the purpose of the organisation that we're talking about, and if it is
That's
a
the
way
point
that's
that's being made,
seeming,
I think. Yes. Yeah.
but let's be clear, that most men do not have access to the Reform Club or the Garrick or these great men's clubs. They're a very narrow a narrow sector of the male population that can either afford them or be invited to take part. So it's not quite the same as the argument about, clubs that are open for all women and whether trans people should be allowed into them. So from that point of view, I suppose it is a bit more difficult of an argument. I inherently think there is something worrying about, groups of highly influential people getting together without, and cooking things up, as it were. And that I think is independent. I think simply allowing highly connected, influential women into those organizations while still excluding the majority of people of itself, I'm not sure is the issue really.
So my argument about just needing to get away and think about things in a sort of a independent space is a little bit naive. You think that there really is something about these gatherings that is insidiously covert
You don't need
as
a
a
club to
potential.
do that. You don't need a sort of a big historical institution to just get away in small groups and discuss things. There certainly is. We may have had this discussion before, but when the council was being heavily criticised by the Conservatives for having produced a paper on possible cuts, which included that had on it the closing Battersea Library. Not something they would ever do, but a kind of thinking the unthinkable. Then they were, you know, told they should publish it and so on. It's actually very able to have some discussions behind closed doors, but there is a line between having the discussions behind closed doors and then being very open about why you've come to a conclusion that you have, and the whole thing being cooked up and never seeing the light of day. And I think the latter, I guess, is the danger of some of these institutions.
And I suppose to take the sort of look at it through the other end of the telescope, the closure of libraries on the scale that we've seen from their initial, I suppose, cultural status as palaces of learning, demotic palaces of learning, was thought by many to be a sort of effectively a political intervention that effectively would actually, on the pretext that people were doing more things online, would exclude certain crucial groups from opportunities for learning, particularly when education, public education, was a bit challenged and of variable quality.
Yeah, I think it is transparent.
Sorry,
yeah,
as long as it's stated what the purpose is of excluding women, that men want to be together without women. I mean, there is an overlap with same-sex marriage. I mean, that's a declaration. It's an all-male union.
And that it's not expressing abject hostility to women. It's simply saying, look, this is our space. You're welcome to your space.
Yes, presumably same with gay clubs, whether mixed or single sex. It's all a question of declaration. That means you choose the product. And so as long you have, it has to be declared what it is. And as long as it's transparent and not against the law. I mean, it's separate from secrecy. I think secrecy has to be, is a different issue. There is a Secrecy Act, for example. You can ask the judge whether he's a member of any secret society.
Any secret society?
Yeah, of course, because he might be biased. He may know a member in the secret society who's acting against you in some way, or speaking against you, is biased against you.
It's a very important point. I wasn't aware that that was enshrined in statute.
Yes, absolutely.
Very reassuring to know. It's interesting. This is a week where MI6 appears to be pushing a diversity policy. I suppose you could say that's a sort of club from which there is no resignation clause.
Well, the principle there is that foreign powers shouldn't be aware of what the secret society is doing, the secret society being the secret services.
Mm.
So a secret service is providing the services of secrecy as its main, its defining attribute. And it's obvious and declared as to why that's necessary. It certainly is necessary. But they again have laws as to what they can or can't do. And the whole issue with the fossil industries was that they're working too closely with the secret services. And in fact, to exclude the renewable energies services. Mm. Which they're not allowed to do.
So is the implication then that, say, a more diverse decision-making matrix would make the sort of default, how could I put it, old boys network more challengeable?
Well, that's what, you know, the laws and the constitution have worked that out previously. It's people not obeying the laws or getting around them that is the problem. I mean, that's the way laws are formed, is people have a cultural connection. And as Einstein and Freud said, the will of the people becomes becomes the law of the people, the community. So, I mean, that's the formation of societies. And that's what they talk about in their essay on how to avoid war, why war. in which they had in the we spoke about it last year, last week, on in 1932, which is a very contextual, relevant point in history. And they didn't get anywhere. It's interesting to then apply it now to the Gaza situation.
And I think really informed histories of how these conversations are formulated.
Yeah, I think you can.
Very fine thing.
You can see the forces playing out in what are the Palestinians doing since they don't have power? They're linking up with foreign countries, the neighbors, and forming a neighbor group, which is more powerful than Israel. So, I mean, the failure of Israel to follow its own constitution, indeed its religious laws, you know, is defining whether it's going to win or lose. I mean, that's the interesting thing about the Bible, which I talked about. This friend of mine has written a psychoanalytic book on the
Bernard Burgoyne, yeah.
The Ten Commandments.
Oh, right.
The significance of the Ten Commandments is the first law, of course. But it was it's a requirement for the survival of the whole people, then called a race. So it wasn't an option as to laws which you may or may not obey. It was more or less a set of rules that unless you follow, you won't survive as a people. So if you apply that to Gaza, you know, how many of the Ten Commandments are they breaking?
Well, indeed. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, in terms of theology, as you find in Islam, statecraft, in ancient China is bound up in this, isn't it? There is a philosophy, as it were, that underpins this, that I think is perhaps a little underplayed in how people read, say, a biblical text or a religious text. And
The way Islam spread, of course, is that the Quran says if you emigrate to another country, you have to follow the laws of that country. You don't take your laws, your native laws, with you. You have to give up your native laws and abide by the new country, the laws of the new country you're going to, which is a kind of is a very effective means of not creating
caliphates and so forth. Just not long ago, I seem to remember he was then in the Lord's Rome, Williams, I presume still is, arguing for at least a serious gather at Sharia law rather than the demonization of it, and that Islam was becoming such a force majeure in the land. I mean, Mal, what's your take on this in terms of where are we going with this, I suppose? We're thinking about transparency, statecraft, and a degree of secrecy. We started off talking about MI6 as a mooted increasing diversity policy. Does this imbue itself with the national culture more effectively? Can we have better conversations sui generis by doing so?
I think it's in the wider context of continuing to get to grips with the implications of multiculturalism, and something which has really become much more obvious, I think, since last October, as to how we manage to reconcile the two very different challenges. On the one hand, as I broadly do, we are welcoming different cultures, learning from them, enjoying that. But then saying, yes, but that doesn't mean that we bow down to every culture out there. There are certain things that characterize what Britain is, and anybody who comes to Britain will be expected to stick to that. And one of those, obviously, is the law of the land, and not having different parallel legal systems running based on the particular, religious beliefs or any other beliefs of any individual group, whereby they can opt out of the laws and the customs of the which have become sort of Britain. And there's no fixed British character any more than there is in any other country. It's continued to grow and you know, richen or enrich, become enriched as more groups have settled here. But I think there is a sense at the moment, and it's not entirely without foundation, that we're coming to a bit of a crunch as to whether we do say, okay, certain groups can be allowed to follow their own philosophies and their own laws as far as they want to go, even if that means imposing those on other groups within the community and potentially damaging those other groups within the community, or whether we need to say no. You know, there comes a point where welcome as everyone should be in our country, I think, but welcome only insofar as they accept the broad outline of how we go about doing our collective national business. And I think that as an issue is it's become more clear as we've seen the centre of London, you know, really just become a very, very different place on Saturdays. Those marches don't, in some ways, don't feel the way that Britain usually does things. And certainly I think some of the anti-Semitism is just frightening and shocking getting here against, of course, the wider British culture of you know, being very tolerant to. So difficult to keep those two things going. Can you still hear me?
I can, yes, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry, my Bluetooth's playing. Oh. Yeah, that bit more difficult to square, you know, our willingness to allow protest or encourage protest, but not to say that protest must not then become at the expense of other groups in society. And there's a whole lot of these issues. You know, with MI6, on the one hand, wanting to widen cultural, yeah, the type of people who get engaged in MI6, but not doing it in such a way that it then becomes easier for foreign powers or foreign groupings that don't have the country of best interests at heart, the very opposite, making it easier for those groups to infiltrate our security services and potentially pass messages back to their home countries. So not an easy balance to draw, but I suspect it's one that we're going to have to face up to soon.
Yeah, indeed. I wonder if we could, well, there are two ways we could head, really, amongst many others. George Monbiot, your law student, is talking about the people's primaries that have been taking place initially in South Devon, but the template is being mooted in other parts of the country ahead of what appears now to be an autumn election. And I suppose intimating in this piece and Commodus Ria the Gornia, that there's a certain disenfranchisement, and I'm wondering that it, to some extent, extends to people's impulses to which you were just referring, of trying to set up parallel sets of laws and ethics in their own fiefdom, or the attempt to do that. And the fact that he notes that a broadly centre-to-centre-left British caucus has consistently found itself with right-wing governments due to first past the post. First of all, I wonder if you agree with that contention, which is from the organisation pressure group Compass, and what you make of the idea of people effectively getting around the table, listening to some candidates who say they are best placed to beat the incumbent, which is typically a Tory.
Well, I mean, first of all, there's absolutely no reason why people shouldn't get together in any way they want to and have those sorts of discussions. And if there is, the Lib Dems and the Greens pretty much did that in Richmond in the 2022 council election, where they did divide up the seats and had a policy of not standing against each other, which was phenomenally successful. Richmond was Conservative controlled 8 years ago. There's now not a single Conservative councillor in Richmond. And the Greens, with about six seats or something like that, I don't know the exact number, are the official opposition. And in many cases, they got those seats because Liberal Democrats stood down and didn't compete with them. And the Greens did the same in others. So there is both, you know, history of this kind of thing and a record that in at least some circumstances it can be very successful. And so why not? I'm sceptical that if people really do feel that there's a single way forward to oppose the Tories, then
they should join a particular party that does that. I think the as we saw, you know, as recently as 2010, the Lib Dems were sufficiently far from Labour that they could enter a coalition, and many in Labour still haven't forgiven the Lib Dems for that. In Scotland, the SNP and Labour are, indeed in Westminster over the last 2 weeks, pretty much all the attacks the Scots Nationalists have made in the House of Commons have been against Labour, not against the Tories. And the idea that, you know, Labour and the SNP could form a comfortable so-called progressive alliance against the Tories in Scotland seems to me to be pretty fanciful, the way politics are at the moment. So we shouldn't, I think, expect too much of this. But if people do want to get together and say, right, we've looked at the candidates on offer, and if you really are keen on getting a Conservative out, this is the candidate we think is best. Well, that's democracy in action. There can't be anything wrong with that.
Mm. What I find curious, and Monbio questions, is why mainstream politicians have consistently rejected the idea of moving towards proportional representation or something like it, with the exception of the Lib Dems. I don't know how strong they are on that now. And can I ask you to comment that on that at the moment? But Graham, what's your take on the idea of people's primaries?
Well, I think it's just a cultural shift and the choice of how you do something in response to the technology available. Now the information is much more widely available on social media and the internet. So people are getting their information from different sources and not from their political parties. So they're not dependent on their political parties for the ideology as such. So the ideologies are, in the first instance, fragmenting, and it's interesting to see how they'll reform. I mean, Angela Rayner was very interesting on The Rest Is Politics, in that she said, you know, people think that politics is all beyond them, and it's out of their control, and it's just about forming laws and acts. But at the heart of it is just the argument about forming arguments and making the arguments and arguing things out until you agree on what you want, which everyone can participate in. You know, so I think it's an indication that people are demanding more participation in politics and are not happy with this top-down approach. And I think that's where Starmer is very weak, and he's being criticised heavily because he's just saying, look, you have to do what I say, and I'm not going to
tell you. Perhaps the implication is that someone else is telling him to say that.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do either, and. And also that he's not going to follow the Constitution and reverse Brexit. You know,
you remind me of something that John Harvey Jones said about leadership, but it was about the art of persuasion, which you seem to be implying that Starmer must not be very good at, as opposed to say sort of.
Well, he's. I think everyone sympathetic to the position he's in, that he has to maintain a sort of bland position, so that no one can argue against him. And he was just going to be voted in by
default. From J.C. Flanell sort of thing, yeah. Mm.
So, but that, you know, he may not lose on that, he may not win on that strategy.
Well, on the other hand, yes, exactly.
I mean, it's quite believable that people are just not going to vote for Sunak anymore. And so therefore they'll turn to Starmer, because on the expectation of what he's going to do. But I think Angela Rayner's point is the stronger and more acceptable one. You know, I mean, people want to hear what the arguments are. You can't just accept on faith, which is what Starmer's relying on in the history of the Labour Party, and relying on the fact that the Tories will just go for the traditional areas, but that's is not in the end, and it's not fundamentally fair in a way, and I think that's what he's in danger of being seen not to be fair to tell people what he's going to do, what his plans are.
Yeah. So if we bring in Owen Jones, who had an op-ed in again in the Guardian this week, saying that after 24 years, he was, surprise, surprise, going to resign from the Labour Party membership and be part of something called We Deserve Better. Are we looking at a sort of an overused phrase, existential crisis, with the idea of business as usual and continuity and the sort of, you know, Thatcher-Blair continuum? Mal, do you think, is this a flash in the pan, or do you think the natives are getting a bit restive?
Well, there's very, where else can the Labour Party go? They're going to inherit an enormous national debt, an enormous national deficit, without any of the leeway to do the sort of things that we want Labour governments to do, which is to, you know, spend a lot of money on public services, get them going again, then gradually run out of money and hand over to the Tories to put the economy right again. They're not inheriting the economy that they kind of need to do. And therefore, there's hardly any space to do anything very radically different from what the present government's doing.
And how do you make that sexy, crisis, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Mm. That's going to be a crisis for both parties coming to grips with that, I think. So, Owen Jones, I mean, I think he's articulate, and I've always rather liked him and found him interesting to listen to. I think he's gone over the edge somewhat with his vehement position on Palestine, and not in any sense able to see that there are two different sides there to look at. And I don't imagine that the Labour high command will be terribly upset at him moving away. In the same way a number of the others on the left of the party have done, either voluntarily or not in recent years. And Starmer will, you know, at this stage in the cycle, it is important for Starmer not to frighten the horses and to be seen as an extremely safe pair of hands, when that's what the country most needs, is not another Liz Truss or anyone who's going to take us off in crazy direction, but someone who is going to broadly follow orthodoxy and economic orthodoxy, and try to gradually put the economy back together in a way that it can start delivering as we need to on public services. But I don't envy any, you know, whoever wins the next election is going to have it very, very tough. And I just find that Owen Jones and those like him are still too wedded to a kind of populist view that there are some very, very simple solutions out there that we just haven't applied properly in the past. I don't think that takes us further forward either.
Mm. So is the idea of We Deserve Better then, perhaps, Jones seems to be skirting around the idea of a sort of pressure group that isn't expecting to make any significant electoral dent. I suppose it could split the vote in some places along the lines of the People's Primaries suggestion with Compass. But the idea that they will actually be an effective opposition where the Tories perhaps won't be.
His starting point in the Guardian article was that Labour are going to win the next election very, very handsomely. And so what he's doing is trying to make sure that the pressure that used to be exerted from within the Labour Party to the left continues to be exerted, but he doesn't think that can be done from within the Labour Party now. So he wants to move towards a more popular-based movement in order to do that. And you know, parties go through these periods. It's the nature of the way we do things. You mentioned first past the post. Of course, the reason why Tories and Labour don't like proportional representation is that it would remove the possibility of them ever forming a majority government again. There would be permanent negotiations between elections as to or after an election, as to what particular constellation of a mixture of parties that were elected would get there. And we have to recognise that there have been a number of areas. If you look at the way proportional representation works in Israel or in Germany at the moment, it does hand quite a lot of power to the extremes of politics they don't have in first-past-the-post systems. And, you know, I don't, you know, like to refer to Hitler almost ever, but Hitler got into power because of the proportional system in Germany, allowing him to become chancellor on 30-odd% of the vote, and then to impose his will on the whole system by removing elections and becoming taking over the position of a dictator. That's a lot more difficult in a first-past-the-post system where you've got two fairly sensible main parties, as we still have, which are going to and it is always one or other of those that's going to form the government, maybe now and again in coalitions, we saw in 2010. So there is a kind of self-interest clause around proportional representation, which is not attractive to either big parties, and of course is massively attractive to the Lib Dems and to Reform and to the smaller parties, because they get a much bigger foothold under proportional representation. So the arguments, there are arguments in both directions. You do have this particular link between an elected representative and their constituency under our current situation, which has a number of attractive features. And the fact is, in the Blair years, the Lib Dems were a lot more influential than the Conservatives were, and the government of the Blair with this massive majority governed in a way that was much more satisfactory to the Lib Dems than it was to the Conservatives. The idea that you've got to have seats in Parliament to be influential in the way debate is emerging, I think, is incorrect. I'm in two minds on first past the post. I always have been. I know for me personally, it would be very, very much more difficult for independents to be elected in what you would inevitably have a much bigger wards with multi-party wards, multi-member wards, perhaps wards electing up to 9 councillors. And then you just need to get to know an awful lot more people. So it'd be very difficult to put and what it does, particularly in those list systems, which most proportional representation involves, where the party decides who their top candidate is, who their second candidate is, who their third candidate is, it puts massive power into the hands of the political parties and away from any independent thinking members they might have, because those members can be removed very easily simply by the next election coming along. They're still on the list, but they're, say, in position number 6, and their party's only expected to win 4 of the 9 seats. So you can get rid of people very easily. Whereas it's much more difficult to get if they're being elected as the person, then a personal vote is an element of what's happening. You do see where the a local party or a local area rather will elect someone they like over and above party label from time to time, and that possibility is just removed if the party is in charge of every breath and every dot and comma that a candidate may come out.
Now, that's exactly what's been levelled at Starmer, really, isn't it? And I suppose, potentially, if you think of the effect of Reform UK and before that Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party on the way the Tories have gone, and they're sort of, I suppose some would say, existential crisis, that phrase again right now, by dint of that, the suggestion that Reform UK is going to make some fairly significant gains or dent the Tory vote, possibly even the Labour vote next time around. Graham, what do you think about this idea of a politics as pressure group and the idea that you don't actually have to be within the Chamber of Westminster to be significantly influential in the direction of travel?
I think that's what Georges Monbiot is doing, is supporting a lot of different pressure groups.
He is, yes.
He seems to be being quite effective. He did that very effective campaign on the water companies, but I think that, the question of existential questions comes back to the parties not arguing them out before the election and coming to a conclusion about what they're going to do about it. I mean, Rachel Reeves is doing a very good job of how she's going to keep the economy steady. But they seem to have lost the whole 28 million billion argument on the green policies, and that they won't be able to afford it. So she didn't really make the arguments for the basic principles of investment. I mean, you invest in something in order to make more money. So it should be able to pay for itself if, by investing in green technologies. And we're losing out on not investing in the new technologies by them all going to America or China, which so we may be too late, you know, when we finally, if we wait for our economy to come right. That's why I'm with Angela Rayner in saying that you have to work out the arguments, and everyone has to know what the arguments are. And it's never enough to say, well, we don't know what's going to happen, because we've all been there before. I mean, with the law, following Islamic law, for example, I mean, Warren Hastings, he took 17 years to defend himself in Westminster Hall against Burke, who was saying that you cannot allow Indians to apply their own law. And it was the beginning of British racism in a way in the empire. So these things have been worked out over and over again throughout history. So it's no good saying, well, we can't actually say what's going to happen in the future. We have to wait and see. And then when we get in, we'll work it out depending on the conditions. I mean, it's obvious to everyone that we're continuing on talking ourselves into extinction by not making any decisions. I mean, all the actors have backtracked on their commitments to global warming. And now 2023 was, we actually reached 1.5 degrees centigrade above, which we, Paris Agreement, we all agreed, the whole world agreed that we were going to keep under it. And it's no good blaming Putin. I mean, we should just name the war as the war for against extinction, because he's fighting an energy war. It's exactly what he's increasing the CO2 emissions and methane emissions by waging war. He's forcing people to raise
emissions. Another election with an 80% majority, allegedly. Yeah.
Yeah, but everyone can see it's a completely fake election. And
well, there's failing the key to this, really, isn't it? In the sense that the degree to which this is misrepresentation presumably has wider ripples, because everything connects to geopolitically.
Well, that's the Brexit argument. You know, I mean, everyone knows it was a fake election, a fake referendum. It was just done by social media. And that's how Putin operates.
Mm.
So he won his election by extending social media into actually killing people and disempowering them.
Mm.
It's all a question of degree, but I mean, Europe is playing a not being too smart in not giving the weapons to Ukraine. As America, you know, and Trump, they don't seem to understand it either. I think Biden does, and Trump doesn't.
Well, I suppose some cynics suggest that it's the Halliburton Corporation is going to come along and help with the rebuild and make lots of money that way. So a little bit of creative destruction, the Hayekian sense, might be the order of the day before more weapons turn up. But just a thought.
Yeah, Churchill's perception was that Hitler was definitely going to go to war, but the Labour Party didn't believe him, and he was right and they were wrong. You know? So it's something that has to be done, you know, and every government is making those kind of calculations, including Xi Jinping.
Indeed. So that's where the a bit of canny forecasting might be done, but certainly by Starmer right now. Talking of referenda, Leo Varadkar resigned after one this week, and There's speculation in the Irish Times, particularly and elsewhere, about what it might take to get to a united Ireland. Michelle O'Neill is now First Minister, the Vice President of Sinn Féin. Do you see that being on the cards? And what do you make of Varadkar's legacy? Mal, do you want to lead on this?
Well, he was humiliated in these. I think it was an example of... So Ireland has moved enormously in liberal terms. There was always the thought that a Catholic country would never accept same-sex marriage. And they had a huge referendum result in favour of allowing same-sex marriage. But this one is pushing it towards the boundaries of where I think many people felt it was beyond comfortable, where the tail was beginning to wag the dog in terms of some of the woke agenda, and turned quite strong against him. And he's clearly come to a view of saying the feeling he can't continue to govern in those circumstances, which has a certain honour about it. In terms of if you look at the demographics of Ireland, they've been moving towards the Catholic side for some time. But further than that, there's been this very significant growth of the non-partisan part of the community, where younger people in Ireland are much less wedded to Protestant or Catholic. In Northern Ireland, particularly talking about now, obviously. The Alliance Party, the non-sectarian party, has been doing increasingly well in elections in Northern Ireland in recent years. The fact that there is a Sinn Féin First Minister, although it makes very little practical difference in the way that the constitution is set up, but symbolically it is quite enormous. I suspect Sinn Féin will push the issue, because they wouldn't want to get in the position the Scots Nationalists got themselves of losing a referendum and that then putting the thing back quite a long way. But increasingly, you know, the possibility of a united Ireland, which I hope could be done peacefully. The danger, of course, is that you get a revival of loyalist terrorism in that circumstance. But it looks possible. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but it's progressively been looking more possible for some time, I think.
What happens to the idea of unionism? I mean, Arlene Foster was chair of something called Safeguard the Union, or something, words to that effect, several groups along those lines. And Graham, is this a tortuous road ahead or an inevitable one?
Going back to why war? The Northern Ireland, I mean, Tony Blair, I think, was appointed in some sort of role for Israel.
Yeah.
On the basis
of... How's that work out? No Mo Bolam, is he, evidently? Yeah.
No, but you can see the principle in Northern Ireland that does seem to be working. He, whoever achieved it, I mean, they have got the animosity between the Protestants and Loyalists to lower considerably, and now they get on with each other a lot better. There's always backsliding, but I think the Loyalists will see that they'll be better off in Europe, and so they have a united Ireland, and they'll be better off without the UK. They'll be united in Europe rather than with the UK.
That's quite a turnaround, but I mean, it makes logical sense.
Well, I think this is the way people vote, the way people experience politics, is they see their advantage, and they will see their advantage in Europe more than in the Union. And so the Union will no longer have a very strong argument. And since Starmer is not going to sort out Brexit, they won't be voting for him. They'll be voting for Sinn Féin.
Does this have an implication for the constitution over here, though, historically? Or is it simply, you know, an acceptable period of, you know, temporary seismology?
Well, of course, we have a constitution for United Kingdom.
Mm.
It's all the countries together, which wasn't advanced, but the European constitution is a more advanced constitution than the British constitution.
And a new one will have to be drawn up for a united Ireland, won't it? Which could take quite some time, I imagine.
Well, yeah, sure. But I mean, the voting way would be the simplest way for it to happen.
Are we talking about another referendum?
the genius of the Friday thing is that you just vote when you want to join. If you want to join, you just vote for it, and that's what you've got to do. So you presumably would then join the Ireland constitution.
Could we attempt a little bit more predictive detail here, Mal? How do you see this panning out, if indeed it does? Would you go with Graham's suggestion that the unionists will be quite pragmatic about the economic advantages of Europe, if indeed they be so?
It was interesting that in Northern Ireland, the main party then, the DUP, was in favour of Brexit, but the Northern Irish Popular Vote was in favour of remaining. There was this different pattern in all of the four nations of the United Kingdom. So what we have at the moment is Northern Ireland is really getting the best of two very good deals. That it's in effect, part still of the single market and the customs union when it comes to relations with the EU. But it also doesn't face the tariff barriers that the EU does when it comes to importing UK goods for use in its own market. If it did become united, Northern Ireland would lose that tariff-free relationship with the United Kingdom, or almost certainly would, because there would now be a very simple, straightforward sea barrier between the European Union and the United Kingdom. At the moment, of course, we have a land barrier between the UK and the EU, which is complicating matters enormously. With the United Ireland, that would dissolve, and there now just be a sea barrier, which is much easier to manage in many ways. So there would be a danger that Northern Ireland could lose some of its trading links with the UK if it joined the EU bloc. And Northern Ireland is much, much more dependent on the UK for its trade than it is for the EU at the moment. So it's not an easy calculation. But generally speaking, most of these decisions aren't made on cold calculation. The vote to leave the EU wasn't done on that. It was done on a far more emotional, because the leave side realised much better and were much better at implementing the recognition that if they could build a simple to understand campaign based on some very simple inspiring messages, they'd get a lot further than all of the analysis that was coming out of the Remain campaign.
And they just lied to make them simple, make the argument simple.
Well, I mean, neither side's arguments stood up to
scrutiny.
Yeah. There was a great deal of the Remain argument in terms of the economic effects if we left had not turned out to be the case, certainly not in the short term.
As predicted.
But the argument being put forward was one where you can't really say, taking back control is a lie. You can argue the money on the side of the bus.
It was a deception.
Aspiration.
It was a deception, right? Because they didn't finish the sentence. They didn't say we're taking back control to government, not to you.
How would this translate, gentlemen? I mean, moving this across to the United Ireland, how could it encapsulate the prospect with a reasonable chance of success? How would you describe as the issues at stake? I mean, this is going to be swallowing a pride, isn't it? There's going to be swallowing a historical enmity while respect for the history. What? And then embracing Europe, effectively.
Uniting.
Northern Ireland might find it a bit of a stretch.
It's easier for Northern Ireland than it is for Europe to go, for UK to go back into Europe, I would have thought.
Probably right.
But I mean, it's for the increased continuing raising of living standards. I mean, we have a crisis of living standards. We have a crisis in just about every aspect of the UK life.
Ireland boomed when it first joined the EU, didn't it? I mean, Dublin became huge financial centre.
Dublin did.
If I remember rightly, yes.
Well, that's the way joining the UK seems to work. I mean, Spain, the economy leapt and the economy you know, it's of great benefit to be in the trading union. I mean, that's the basic reason for going in, is to get rid of the borders. You know, I mean, that's why it's so idiotic. That's the basic lie, is that if you put up borders, you're going to find it easier to trade.
You're good at lobbing things like Lee Anderson, I suppose, or something like that.
Well, I mean, there's another guy who's... I mean, it's all about the perception of reality, isn't it? And persuasion. And that's why, you know, talking ourselves into extinction is literal. I mean, if you don't understand how the planet is going extinct, then you're not going to do anything to prevent it. Mm. And we're now a lot... The probability of us going extinct is increasing by the day.
Well,
and not decreasing. We know the technologies we have to apply to decrease the probability, but it's now becoming unlikely we're going to make the decisions in time.
Mm. It's a statistic, statistic from the World Health Organization: 93% of the world's children are exposed to pollution on a daily basis. Pulled me up short. It's been quoted in the context of a report in the Southwest Londoner, marvellous student newspaper, about air quality in South London, measured across 2021 and 2022, in which several boroughs, including Wandsworth, particularly Merton, fared among the worst. And we talked from time to time about Putney High Street and the way in which design was happening there. High-rises trapping polluted air and so forth. Things don't seem to have got an awful lot better, although ULEZ has since been rolled out on a more extended basis. Should there be cause for alarm? What else should we be doing at a regional level, and indeed a London-wide level?
Now, well, actually, what we're seeing in many areas, and we've just seen it in Lambeth around the Streatham Wells, is... A real battle developing around things like low traffic neighbourhoods and the role of the car. And many people feeling that if you live in one of the low traffic neighbourhoods, then it's much easier to use your car and there aren't people driving through. But the effect on Streatham High Road, Streatham High Street, which was becoming entirely blocked. There were photographs of literally a dozen or more buses just simply not moving for
2 hours to move 2 miles on 133 recently. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, which of course drives people out of public transport or means they can't travel at all if the bus network, which is so important for many of the less well-off Londoners, is damaged in that sort of way. And it's quite difficult to keep the wider and more and less urgent... how do I put this? The bigger issues which don't seem to affect people quite as much on the day-to-day basis, it becomes very difficult to keep those in play when the implementation is causing very severe day-to-day problems for people trying to use buses, for those who are having to breathe in the air on Streatham High Street. And again, the nature of the living above the shops is that tends to be very often less well-off people. So it's the less well-off in society who are bearing the brunt of this increased pollution on the border roads of low traffic neighbourhoods. And the row that's developed, and Susan Hall, the Conservative candidate, is making a lot of noise about this, of stopping the war on the car and moving back towards a thing where people are not affected so strongly by anti-car policies, doesn't augur well for a single-minded focus on reducing emission. And Putney High Street has been successful to an extent. The banning of buses from idling and other measures there have noticeably brought down the pollution levels. But these still aren't levels that anybody should feel comfortable that we're exposing people to. But it's finding simply going in and imposing these low-traffic neighbourhoods on people hasn't worked. Wandsworth went through the same thing a couple of years ago. And very quickly back down, probably a sensible move by the then council, and removed pretty much all of them overnight. But you need to be able to bring people with you, which is why, unfortunately, the attitude taken by people like Just Stop Oil of disrupting people's lives is just, it's emotionally very, very stupid, because these are people whose hearts and minds you need to win. And you don't, generally speaking, win people's hearts and minds by shouting at the top of your voice at them. You are evil people. You're not as virtuous as me. And therefore, you deserve to be treated very badly.
I suppose it's sort of this implied sense of panic about this. Graham, what do you make about the design implications of this? I mean, as an inveterate promulgator of blue-green energy, how would this wade in on a problem like this?
Well, it's certainly design of Putney High Street and the design of the cars and the fuel they use that results in excessive pollution. So the rate at which it's transitioned to electric vehicles, then it goes down proportionally in terms of pollution. So you know, the program has started to clean the atmosphere, and I think in many areas you get cleaner air than before. So that's one area, but it's taken far too long. I mean, the basic thing about pollution is the Darwin point that we evolved in a particular ecology, and our bodies are designed to fit those environments that we build, and they have done up until now. And we're just beginning, in terms of hundreds of years, to pollute the atmosphere in a serious degree, which can't be recovered from.
Indeed, it says it causes obviously lung damage. That's not quite the same thing, but the suggestion that mobile phone technology can actually alter the shape of young people's brains, that they become, you know, to some extent synergistic with it.
Yeah, that's now they're getting, the size of taxi drivers' brains is probably the best example.
In many cases. Fred Hounsfield was the other chap.
But people are beginning to notice that they've lost the skill of navigating or reading a map, or if you hand over an aspect or part of intelligence to a machine, then you lose the intelligence, and that's comes into the effect of social media.
Would you describe that design as a sort of a new kind of pollution, one that, as it were, masks the other forms?
It's not inevitable that the mega tech companies designed. I mean, they've got away with theft in a way by changing the law. I mean, Zuckerberg's, famously said there's no such thing as privacy, by which he meant we have access to your information and we're going to keep it. I remember when the technology first began to be introduced, the design implications were that you'd be self-sustainable in information, you'd be self-sustainable in energy. So I designed a house that produced energy rather than consumed it. And now it's only now, 50 years later, they're beginning to be designed, houses that produce energy. Now, if you have all the houses in a city producing energy, the city's producing energy, it produces more energy than it consumes, so it can export it. That is a design principle which wasn't thought through politically, because the national grid design was dominating future policy, and now we're suffering the delays in the fact that the national grid can't handle all the renewable energy that's being provided and isn't going to for 10 or 15 years.
This is Malcolm's sort of immediate specialist field among many. If we have time, would you like to comment on what Graham's saying there about the idea of radically transforming how cities power themselves, and the effect that will therefore presumably have on the need to pollute.
Well, and you can make some moves in cities, and you know, on roof solar is you know, catching on in many areas of the world. Problem obviously is in cities you have an extremely dense power usage, and you can do things about the demand side. You need to do things about the demand side to bring demand down and to spread demand out over the 24 hours. But you still have a very dense power usage, or power usage within cities is extremely dense per unit area of land, far more than you could provide from on-site renewables. So you have to be piping energy into your cities, either literally in gas pipes or metaphorically in electric wires, from somewhere outside. And those areas have to bear the brunt of generating the electricity that is being used for the city. So it's always been a very complex issue with these. Those who to do it with renewables, you need to carpet vast areas very close to London with solar panels, or you need huge transmission networks to bring offshore wind to London.
You can't scale this down to a neighbourhood level. It has to be done on mass.
Well, in neighbourhood, the issue still remains how important it is to have reliable electricity supplies that we can turn to if, for whatever reason, your local generation, be it at a household level or a neighbourhood level, isn't available, because people still need reliable electricity for their electronic equipment and so on and so forth. And that needs an external grid of some description, which can manage changes in demand here and there, and loss of power stations going down here and there, but can smooth over that, because you've got a system which is probably has to be national, at least regional systems of generation. When we tend to forget that when electricity was first catching on at the end of the 19th century, it was pretty much all distributed. It was pretty much all generated locally in very small scale grids, or very small scale, or often individual households or individual factories will be generating their own electricity. And electricity was a luxury good. You know, the vast majority of people could not come anywhere near affording electrical gadgets like electric lighting or the telephone or cooking or whatever it happened to be. Then, of course, you got the emergence of the super grids, the national grid in the UK in the 20s, the rural electrification under Roosevelt's New Deal in the States in the 30s, that in a very short period of time brought grid electricity to huge numbers of rural households in the States. And at that point, the cost of electricity halved pretty much overnight. It became available to more people, and it became more attractive because it was more reliable. If your local farm wind generator wasn't working because it had broken down or because the wind wasn't blowing, then you didn't lose all of your electricity. You could pipe it in through the grid. So it's no surprise that local, what they call distributed generation, collapsed and disappeared as soon as supergrids were available. And there are some areas where we seem to have forgotten that, and there's a push back towards local generation, and it's having some very, very negative effects.
Greg, would you like to comment on that?
I was going to say, it went from local to distribution networks with the invention of alternating current rather than direct current. That's the biggest The banks tried to stop that because you couldn't make as much money. That was the story of Tesla.
Yeah, indeed. But the Tesla-Edison dispute on alternating versus direct current was pretty much over by 1900. Yeah, there was nothing. Years of the 20th century, it was recognized that alternating current would win that battle. But it was only when that came alongside very, very large point sources, mostly fossil generating, but later on, and hydro, but later on nuclear coming onto the picture, where you had reliable sources generating very, very large amounts of electricity at a single point, which is then fed into the grid and distributed. That was when electricity really took off as being a massive benefit for the less well off.
Yeah, that's why it's important to do it from a design principle rather than from a financial gain. The banks weren't going to financially gain, so they tried to stop the alternating current.
Musk of all people took Tesla's name for his motor vehicles.
Well, that's the story, probably.
Indeed. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Any conclusion?
Yeah, I've slipped my mind now. I was going to say, for example, now in answer to Malcolm's thing about intermittency of solar and wind, I mean, now it's just been announced that the third source is going to be thermal storage batteries, which are going to be equal in size to the other energy sources. Which is
hopefully made with themselves of green technology rather than bits of nastiness from the weaker part of China.
The resource implications are just staggering of this, and it could mostly be dug out by poor children in developing countries. But the amounts of lithium and cobalt and copper, not least, and others, some really horrendous. I mean, the world mining industry is rubbing its hands at this thing, because of course the word renewable is one of the great achievements of the green spin industry. They're nothing of the sort. They use vast amounts of once through material that you can't recycle, because although the sun and the wind might renew themselves, the massive infrastructure we need to capture useful energy out of these very dilute energy sources is far, far from renewable. The amounts of solar waste that are already being produced, which you can't do much with it. But because if you put it underground, it leaches into the water supply. There's some very unpleasant stuff in it, but you can't burn it and you can't recycle it. Is there? So yeah, the idea of storage, whether it's thermal storage, battery storage, whatever it is, gravitational storage. But there's always a problem, firstly, that it's inefficient because storage wastes probably around 20% of the original energy just because of normal thermodynamic concepts. And secondly, because of the vast resource implications. Yeah, the capitalist world loves this concept. That's why there's been so much support for renewables, is that it's very, very good for those countries that want to take vast amounts of unpleasant chemicals out of the earth.
Mm. But Graham, presumably over time, this design could refine itself and be a little more green of its own device, wouldn't it?
Well, I was going to say that it's not lithium batteries I'm talking about. I'm talking about rock storage, storage in sand or salt. You know, hot salts, you can then run your turbines off the hot salt. So it's not expensive materials at all.
But then you've got the problem of you've got to store things at that sort of temperature. For it to be worthwhile, it really needs to be molten salt, so up at several hundred degrees C, which are, the idea, and this is not a new concept. It's been around for well over a century. But it's never caught on because it's nothing like as simple as the advocates claim it is, just like most things.
Hasn't caught on because you get bankers like the ones that stopped Tesla.
Well, let's watch this space, gentlemen, and see what happens. Could you send me the link, Graham, and I'll post it up in the blurb for this. Gentlemen, as ever, thank you very much. Enjoy your weekends.
Okay, cheers. Bye.
Did you